Hi, and welcome back to another segment of Our Community. It's been a crazy, depressing, and worrisome couple of weeks now, with our COVID numbers blowing up here in Curry County, and particularly in Brookings Harbor. It's mostly the unvaccinated who are getting seriously ill and being hospitalized with this Delta variant. But several people that I know who are vaccinated are sick with the virus. So I urge you to get tested and quarantine if you're positive for at least 10 days. If negative, please get vaccinated. That will protect you from the worst of the illness. And please start wearing your masks again when around others and especially in an indoor setting. Joining me to talk about the numbers today is Brookings Core Response Executive Director, Diana Cooper. Hi, Diana. This has been quite a couple of weeks for you guys at St. Tim's. How are you holding up?
The whole team really seems to be pushing through. I mean, we're tired, you know. At the end of the day, we certainly are glad to go home, but we're happy to keep pushing through. There's a lot of work to do, so there's not really much time to just rest.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys are basically working 6 days a week, right?
We are working 6 days a week. So, core team obviously is not just doing the vax clinic. Well, St. Timothy's as a whole is not just doing the vaccine clinic or the testing clinic, but we are still running our services in the mornings for people who need resources and housing and things like that. So mm-hmm. We have, you know, our mornings are dedicated to that. Our afternoons are dedicated to testing and vaccines. And then we also are working Saturdays doing the testing clinic, just specifically that. So it's been a lot. And then we have Calor that's stepping in on, now I'm thinking that it's going to be every Tuesday and Thursday. So okay. they're going to step into the clinic on those days. And then core team will be able to do just a little bit more coordination and kind of step in, you know, back into some of our space with working with resources. So there's a lot to figure out, a lot to work out as far as our scheduling, but we know the clinic is open Monday through Saturday, 12 to 3. And then as far as home visiting for testing, I think what we're going to end up doing is Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday during clinic hours, 12 to 3, we'll do home visit tests. And I don't know what all of that's going to look like right now. I did it today and it went pretty well. So yeah, that's kind of what's going on.
So you guys must be a little bit tired. I would just assume that you're a little tired.
Yeah, I don't think there's anybody that's down there that it's not even so much physically, you know, there is a lot of running around, especially doing the outreach portion of it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of running around involved in the clinic itself, but mostly it's just mentally because there's so much, you know, it's a much kind of higher risk than just giving the vaccines or providing the services upstairs and whatnot. This is, you know, we're asking people who are probably sick, that we assume are sick, to come see us. And so it's a kind of a whole different game, and we have to make sure that we're on top of everything, you know, our cleaning, our procedures, our data entry. So it's mentally, it's a little bit burdensome, I guess.
It's more challenging for sure.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. We really have to stay up to date on any changes happening with the CDC and OHA and things that before we could kind of look up as needed. And now, you know, we have to have the information on hand. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot to organize and coordinate. And we had a meeting today. We'll probably end up having a meeting at least once a week with everybody involved. So it's more coordination than we're used to. And
And this is kind of life and death, right? I mean, this is a deadly virus. Right?
It's funny when we're, I guess it's not funny, but you know, when we're talking about work and stuff and people are saying like, well, you know, if you don't answer that call, if you don't do this, nobody's going to die. Well, like the same applies, you know, nobody's going to die like right now if we don't answer, but it's just a little bit different. It's a different level of awareness and mm-hmm. A different level of kind of sort of being on guard and knowing that we need to make sure we are timely with our information and timely with our communication with everybody.
So what are the numbers looking like? You've been doing this now for what, like 2 weeks?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, mm-hmm. 2 weeks. That sounds right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So right now it's kind of looking, we started off with a bang. I mean, it was just a ton of positives. You know, with our overall testing, it was a very high percentage of positives. I mean, right at the beginning, we were getting anywhere from 25 to 30% positivity rate.
Wow.
And yeah, so, That's high. I think that was just because we had just gotten a surge and we didn't realize it really. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when people first heard about us, everybody that thought they were probably positive came down and, and most were positive. So we're seeing that slim out. And now, you know, we're a little under 20%, I think, overall, a little under 20% positivity rate. And I don't have the exact figure because we're still, I mean, like I said, the data entry is definitely the most time consuming part and we don't want to mess anything up. And so while everything gets reported right away to Oregon Health Authority, as far as our own numbers and our own keeping track, sometimes it's just very difficult to, you know, the numbers are there. They're reflected in OHA. Right. But as far as what has St. Timothy's done out of those numbers, we can tell you our positives. But as far as overall testing, sometimes we just have to keep pushing on because there's just no time to stop and do all the counting. But
I had heard the number 80 as positives. Do you think that is
for
anywhere?
St. Timothy's?
Yeah, for St. Tim's for the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, Bernie actually has totals, and so I probably should have asked him that. I mean, it's definitely at least that.
Oh,
so
okay. Yeah, that's a lot of cases. That's a lot of cases. 80.
It was more
community.
Than we expected. I don't know, you know, what everybody, where everybody else was at, but me personally going into this, that's more than I expected to, you know, see firsthand. So.
And I get the sense that St. Tim's is the only place testing in the area. I mean, I know that Curry Health Network has been referring people to you, and I have heard that some of the pharmacies in Crescent City are referring to you. So
yeah, that's a recent development.
Holy mackerel.
Right, I know. So there is other testing going on in the county. We know for sure there is because the numbers reflected are larger than our numbers. So, and that happens, I don't know if there's been a day where the numbers weren't larger than ours. But you know, definitely I look at the numbers every day. I compare them to our numbers and sometimes it's just one or two. Although I feel like there was a day where there was a good 20 more than we reported. And I think I know, you know, there was an outbreak at a specific place. And I think that it was, you know, 16 or 17 were contributed to that. So, that day we had tested 12 positive. So if it hadn't been for the outbreak, it probably would have looked more like 15 positives total or 16 maybe. So, there is other testing going on for sure. And then we know that the assisted living facilities are able to do their own testing now, or the majority of them. And there are other testing sites. You know, Fred Meyer's is a testing site. And
it is?
So, they
I
do
didn't
have
know
their.
That.
Yeah. So there's this number you have to get if you're going to do COVID testing, and it's called a CLIA number.
Okay.
And St. Timothy's has a CLIA number. And you can look up for the entire county. And I think there's seven places, not including us, seven other places that have CLIA numbers. And some of those are like, you know, Curry General Hospital and Brookings Medical Center. And not Brookings Medical Center, I'm sorry. Like Curry General Hospital and then, you know, the Curry Health Network kind of down here.
Right, the ER.
I don't know why I can't think of what it is right now. You know, there's actually probably like six others. Yeah, Fred Meyer's is one, the assisted living places, and then I don't remember all of the rest. So we certainly are doing a lot of testing that's reflected in those numbers, yes. And we are getting referrals from Crescent City.
The ones from Crescent City, if they live in Crescent City, they've got to be reported to California.
Yes.
They end up not being part of our numbers.
Yeah, so and that kind of depends too, because if they're staying up here, mm-hmm. like some people have a second home up here and things like that. So then, you know, those we report those numbers to Oregon Health Authority with the address mm-hmm. that they're living at here.
Right.
But yes, people who live in other areas, it has to be reported in the area that they live in. And so it's a little bit confusing to kind of explain it, but that's basically how it works.
So I assume that OHA is contracting with you guys, right? I mean, is that the,
yes.
Because they yeah. sort of took over our public health. So
right. They right. are contracting with us, and mm-hmm. Bernie's kind of doing all the work behind the scenes on that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he knows more of the details, but they just gave us kind of a chunk of money to sort of beef up our efforts here. And we were able to bring on a couple of new people, and actually, I think in total, we'll end up bringing on 4 people. Right now,
oh,
we
that's
have
great.
Yeah, I mean, we were super yeah. relieved today yeah. to have extra hands.
Yeah, I bet.
Especially for data entry, because we can have several people doing data entry, and mm-hmm. that just means that they can go slower, and it's, you know, obviously that lowers our risk for error. And so, yeah, it's great.
And OHA has actually complimented you guys on getting them numbers, right? Because I don't think they were getting numbers for, like, you know, the previous 18 months. So this is important to get numbers, right?
Yeah.
So that
yeah.
we know what the infection rate is.
Yeah. And yeah, I spoke with somebody, gosh, maybe last week. It's kind of all blurring together. So I spoke with somebody about, you know, our testing down here. They had called because they had to get some more info from me. And she said, not that there was no testing, but she was very grateful that we came on board and that all of a sudden they just noticed this kind of explosion in testing and data coming from Curry County. So St. Timothy's Vaccine Clinic, it just, that's how it pops up for them. So
I love it. And I think really the reporting is just hugely important, because if we know where the cases are and we know how many people are testing positive, then we have a sense of whether or not it's blowing up. If it's blowing up, that is really important information, right?
I mean, yes.
You know.
So reporting the negatives and having... Just reporting in general, when people come in and they want to get a test, we just test them, you know. Obviously, if they're like, well, I just hugged someone today, we would, you know, we would tell them to come back in a few days or something. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's possible we would just test them right there anyway. But the idea is that we want to get as much data from Curry County as we can to the state. Mm-hmm. to help them see what it looks like, to get a good picture down here, because...
Right.
You know, we definitely want to make sure the negatives are also reflected, because mm-hmm. you know, it's important to, if somebody's positive, to get those results in and get them connected with services. But the negatives are just as important, because mm-hmm. without having a good idea of how many people are coming in that aren't positive, then all it looks like to the state is that every single person we test is positive, and that's
right.
a big red flag. So
yeah.
being able to test people who you know, obviously, they think they've been exposed. They're not really sure what the case is. So we kind of clarify with them what their situation is. And then, you know, we test them. If they're negative, then that just adds to the overall, like, you know, here's our numbers. Here's our positivity rate. And it actually keeps our positivity rate low. Not that
right.
we're shooting for that, but it certainly does help to report everybody.
And that makes it accurate, right? I mean, you know, again, if you're not reporting the negatives, then, you know, it looks like our positivity
right.
rate is through the ceiling. But, you know, so you have to be accurate, and that means posting,
right.
you know, the negatives
You know, the reason I say is we have had some people, not a lot, but we've had some people ask, if I'm negative, why do I need to stay and put in my information? I'm like, well, if I don't mm-hmm. put your information in, it just looks mm-hmm. like everybody's positive in Curry County.
Mm-hmm.
So they were like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Right,
so, yeah, it's important to get everybody.
So if somebody tests positive, what are they supposed to do next? So if somebody shows up and they've got, you know, some symptoms or whatever, and they test positive, what's the next step for them and for you? Yeah.
If they're positive, so on our end, if they're positive, obviously, we enter that into the database. We refer them to Olivia, who works out of the food bank. She's, you know, they're a CBO contracted with Oregon Health Authority as well. And they're doing relief. So if people can't leave their homes and they have to pay bills, you know, she can help with that. And then we're also actually getting funding to help with that as well. So we'll be able to work alongside the food bank to, because, you know, there's a lot of caseload right now for them. So so we're all going to work on that together. So that's what it'll look like on our end. It'll look like a referral or coordination for services and groceries and bill pay and whatnot. And then on their end, so if they're positive and they have symptoms, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, we heard a lot about 14 days, you know, 2 weeks. 2 weeks was sort of the magic number for everything. And now it's 10 days. And so, you know, obviously there's some scientific research behind why they've changed it to 10 days. So we have positive with symptoms. You're going to isolate for 10 days from the onset of symptoms. So if you come in and you get a test and it's positive and I say, when did your symptoms start? And you say they started yesterday. So I'm going to say, okay, you have 9 more days that you're going to be isolating at home. Isolating is different than quarantine. Quarantine is you're going to, you know, stay at home for the most part. You're going to do your business. You know, you're going to have your family or whatever in the house. So isolate is like you, if you've got others in the house that are negative, you're going to isolate completely from them. So it's not even just about staying home.
So that's a very important piece of information. That quarantine and isolation are two different things.
They are different things, yes. So, you know, quarantine.
So if you're positive, you need to
isolating. Absolutely.
Yeah, got it.
If you're negative and you have been in contact with someone, then you're quarantining, which means you're just going to hang out at home. And it's very similar. It just means, you know, if you've got, you don't have to be quite as strict. And then the 10 days also. So at the end of the 10 days, if you haven't had a fever, you're good to go. If you have a fever, you still need to wait till you're 24 hours fever free. So that's the little caveat to the 10 days for if you're positive and you have symptoms. But if you don't have symptoms, then you come in and test. We test you positive. You're gonna isolate for 10 days from the testing date because you don't know when you got sick. You can probably guess when you were exposed and all of that, but you know, you don't know when you actually would have come up and started becoming contagious. So 10 days from the day you test, if you have no symptoms and you're positive. So those are kind of the two positives. Negative is fairly similar. If you've had close contact, meaning you've been close to someone within 6 feet or I can't remember if it's 6 or 10 feet now, with, you know, for 15 minutes, you're without masks and whatnot. You're going to quarantine for 10 days. Okay. And if you don't have symptoms, you're still going to quarantine for 10 days. Even if you don't have symptoms and you tested negative, you're going to just chill at home for 10 days. If you want to shorten it, you could say 7 days out, you could come in and get another test. And the CDC says, you know, if you're negative, no symptoms, 7 days out, you get another negative test, you're good to go. You're free. So. Okay. It's a little bit confusing, but we do go over this with every person. So you don't have to memorize it. We'll give you a handout, whatever the case.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
So,
yeah. I would imagine that there are, you know, the OHA has a website where you can go find this information as well.
And you can also go straight to the CDC website because that's kind of has some of the better printouts, although we did find some at Oregon Health Authority. The other that I didn't mention is if you're vaccinated, now this is coming from the CDC, and this may change with the variants, but if you're vaccinated and you had a close contact, meaning you weren't wearing your mask, you were standing next to them, they ended up positive, you actually don't need to quarantine or isolate at all, but you should still wear your mask. You can go on about your day. So okay. if they come in, they test negative and they say I was right next to someone and, you know, they stayed at my house for a night or whatever, I'm going to tell them, if you're vaccinated and your test is negative, you're good to go. Just please wear okay. your mask because you in case, just in case something.
But if you've been vaccinated and you have close contact with somebody who tests positive, it would behoove you to get a test, wouldn't it? Because I know that there have been some breakthroughs.
We do recommend, and the CDC and the OHA, we all recommend coming down and getting a test. And you know, if it's positive, then it's a breakthrough. If it's negative, then again, you just wear your mask and you can do your business. But yeah, so if you've been vaccinated and you have close contact, it's still good to come to get a test because we do have breakthroughs.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I know of six. Just offhand, you know,
we've been seeing them as well. Yeah,
you know, that's a lot. Yeah, because I thought, you know, I was so relieved to kind of see what looked like COVID in my rearview mirror. You know, kind of, it looked like it was receding into the right.
I took my mask off for a minute there. I was like, wow, faces. Yeah. I don't even know what to do. I got way too excited. And then, you know, I was still careful anyway. I still was spacing out and I didn't go anywhere other than the store. Right. But once we started doing the testing and the day we left the testing, Michelle and I were just kind of like, I think we're just going to go back to wearing our masks. We just feel better.
Yep. Yep.
Seeing what we're seeing down there, we just feel better.
You know, everybody should get a glimpse into what it is you're seeing because
it would be so lovely. I mean, you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I do. Because I look around and, you know, I go into a grocery store, or, you know, someplace, and nobody's wearing masks.
They've stopped.
It's like, okay, we are in the midst of a big, serious spike. The like of which we have never had before.
Yeah, and it wasn't like
now
this last
we're
year.
Not. No, it wasn't. It wasn't. I mean, we would get a case every now and again.
So I think that in the year and a half, we had like somewhere over 700, just over 700 positive cases.
Mm-hmm.
In 1 week, we've had over 100. So if that doesn't tell anybody anything, I'm not sure what would. Yep. And there are some people, I mean, I don't know how many from this community, but, you know, I get messages and comments and things like that on Facebook and whatnot. There are some people that we're just not going to be able to change their minds. We've put out the information and we're not trying to force testing or vaccines on anyone. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to get the information out for those who want it.
But is it your sense that people who are testing positive are actually isolating?
Quarantining,
either one.
For the most part, yes. Mm-hmm. Isolating. Not everyone. No. Mm-hmm. We know not everyone because, you know, we speak with them, we talk with them. There are some people who literally will tell them they're positive and we know that they're not isolating. And some of them say, you know, it's such a small percentage, but it doesn't really matter, does it? I mean, just knowing that there are some people who will test positive and then not care to stay home. It doesn't matter what it is. You can replace COVID with anything. If you've got the flu, just stay home. If you've got chicken pox, just stay home. You know, it really doesn't matter.
Common sense, right?
So with this, for us, it just feels a little bit more difficult because we know this has caused an entire globe, a global reaction that everybody is affected by. So it sucks, you know, it does.
No, it really does. I've been doing the numbers for KCIW every night. And I just started doing them again because we're starting to spike. Right.
It was a nice break, you know?
Yeah, it was a nice break. So I started to do them and the number that keeps just throwing me is how many people worldwide have died. Mm-hmm. And we are up to 4 million, close to 300,000 people dead. And that's in 18 months. 4 million people. And we are losing globally. We are losing about 10,000 people a day. They're dying.
It's almost even hard to...
I know.
You know, it's almost even hard to kind
How do you even wrap your head around that, right? I know. And there are like the difference between yesterday's numbers and the day before, globally, we gained 100,000 cases.
Mm-hmm.
Just in 24 hours globally.
Yeah, and that's like half of Curry County dying every single day. I mean,
I know. It's appalling at a level that, you know, if you don't actually give it some thought, you can easily think, oh, well, you know, a few people here and there. But really, I mean, 4 million people are dead. That's a lot of folks. A lot of folks. So is there any kind of a follow-up for people who have tested positive? Like is anybody checking with them to see how they are or, you know, any of that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So we contact Olivia, like I said, and make the referral there. So she does follow up as far as, her team check in. Yeah, mm-hmm. They check in regularly because they have to make sure people have groceries and bills paid. So they have to check in with them pretty frequently. And then OHA actually does check in as well. I don't know what that looks like, but I the only reason I know that they check in is because several people have told me, oh, I already got a call from OHA. And so I would ask the name and they would tell me, and it's not someone on Olivia's team. So I know that it was actually OHA and not like someone contracted. So, and then also, you know, I've had, if we hit enter on our data and it enters it into the OHA system, if there's something wrong, they'll call us within, you know, a couple hours.
That's great.
So we're very confident people are looking at this very quickly. And, you know, it's a little nerve wracking because I know, like, well, they're looking at our data. So if we screw something up, but it's also comforting because if we screw something up, they're gonna catch it.
Yeah, exactly. Which is definitely comforting. Yeah.
And they'll, you know, I've gotten the call. I didn't mess anything up, but I have gotten the call a couple of times to get more information. So and it's usually within like an hour of me hitting submit. So
it's great. That's excellent.
Yeah.
So of all of the positive results in the past 2 weeks, do you have a sense of how many are seriously ill?
It's not very many that we don't see them when they're really, really ill. We see them, we've seen some that are, you know, pretty sick. They've got all the symptoms, they're not feeling good. And usually, sometimes it's been kind of elderly and they're feeling really sick and they're having a hard time, walking or breathing or whatnot. And so they're not to the point where it's like hospital worthy, but they don't feel good.
Right.
And we don't know once we're done testing. I mean, I suppose once we start doing the wraparound care with Olivia and kind of alongside, we'll understand that more. Olivia certainly sees the progression over the period of their isolation and is able to, you know, capture like how many people are ending up in the ER, how many people are, you know, improving. And so she has a much better grasp of what it looks like when they leave our clinic. You know, what does it look like during their isolation period? So I don't know how many of the people that leave St. Timothy's with a positive case end up in the hospital. The last number I heard as far as people hospitalized, and some of these were not tested at St. Timothy's, was 5, but I believe that number has gone up. Locally. I don't know the numbers for who's in Curry and who's in you know, other areas. So
Right. So is it your sense that the people who are testing positive are vaccinated for the most part or not vaccinated?
It's our sense that the majority of people who come in who are sick are unvaccinated. And we have had some breakthrough cases at this point. It's been very few, but we've had them. And certainly, You know, we are taking all the precautions we can because regardless of the fact that we're all vaccinated, we're right there with it. You know, sometimes we're just a few feet away for a good 5 minutes or so while we're entering data. So people who are vaccinated can certainly get it. And we know that we've seen that now. So,
right. And they generally don't get as sick, obviously. And I think the CDC has said that the majority of the people that they're seeing in the hospitals and dying, like 97%, something like that, 98% are unvaccinated. So,
yeah,
you know, that kind of reinforces that if you are vaccinated, you can catch it still. There is a chance of you catching it, but you probably won't be ill enough that you need to be in hospital.
And that's so, and that other 3% is, you know, you were saying it's about 97% mm-hmm. of the people who get seriously ill or pass away are unvaccinated.
Right.
That other 3% is really still really important to pay attention mm-hmm. to, because when we're, you know, those are typically the people that have some serious underlying conditions, whether it's some, you know, their diabetes is pretty bad, or just that they have diabetes is an underlying condition,
right.
Or they have asthma or things like that. So those who are immune compromised as well, what we do know is that those who are immune compromised can get the vaccine, but it may not have the same efficacy. In fact, they're mm-hmm. saying that it really doesn't have the same amount of protection.
Mm-hmm.
So it is absolutely possible to get it again, to get COVID, and to get some pretty severe symptoms. And someone that we know currently was vaccinated, got sick again, and is having some pretty difficult symptoms.
I'm so sorry.
It's not a fail-safe. And we still, and this person was taking a lot of precautions. Obviously, mm-hmm. it doesn't take much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I said, we're around it down there at the clinic. And so it's just, you know, one mistake or one mm-hmm. issue and one of us could catch it. And we do test ourselves very regularly. So
good. Because several of you have kids at home, right?
Yeah, a couple of us do. I do. Michelle does.
I mean, that's a little worrisome because not all of those kiddos are old enough
right.
to get vaccine yet. So. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's just Michelle and I actually.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we and Michelle and I kind of, you know, we were kind of the first ones that were like, you know what, I think we're going to test ourselves. And then now it's everybody we're testing. And in fact, I think we're putting dedicated testing kits aside for that reason. So
excellent. Yeah, because, you know, if you guys get it. You know,
oh, man.
Know.
We try not to think about that. And every single time someone tests, it's just mm-hmm. all of us standing over the test waiting for it to be done.
With bated breath.
We have no idea. I mean, we'd be fine, but also we have no idea what we would do if one of us got sick. Because it's just, it feels like it requires everyone to function right now because of the surge we're seeing.
Yep, absolutely. So. Absolutely. So I noticed at the city council workshop, on Monday, August 2nd, that none of the city councilors nor the staff were masked.
Oh, yeah, I know.
All but one of us in the audience had our masks firmly in place. But I was a little bit surprised at the lack of caution on the city's part.
I strongly hope that they're vaccinated, and I'm not going to guess. I just hope. That's all. really hope.
And that's a great hope. I really, I absolutely approve of that hope. I'm not sure that I share your optimism, but even if they are vaccinated, the reality is that the Delta variant, which is what is out there now, is breaking through some vaccines.
Yeah.
So even if you're vaccinated, the fact is that you can contract the Delta variant. And if you contract it and think that you are immune because you've been vaccinated, then you are spreading it.
Yeah.
And if you're spreading it to the citizens of your city,
yes,
you might want to think twice about that.
Yes, I think that we, at this moment, I mean, like I said, over 100 cases in a week, and we're talking about just over 700 cases in 18 months. Mm-hmm. So that should give pause to any leadership officials to release a statement, to take measures, anything at all that would just sort of give the understanding that this is where we're at and we want to be as safe as possible. I think that because COVID has gotten so political for some,
mm-hmm,
that there are some that are kind of not willing to take that move because it's, I don't know. I think that maybe they're not willing to get flack for it or whatever the case, mm-hmm, may be. But really, truly, as leadership, they should be doing something. They should be taking some kinds of visible measures that actually mean something, that actually do keep people safe.
And I got an email from Court Boyce.
I did,
County
too.
Commissioner.
I was going to say that, yes.
Right? Good going, Court
Yes,
Boyce.
Yes, very good for Court.
Seriously.
I'm glad he sent that, and I hope that
others
are listening, received it, and are taking that in. But,
yep,
you know, at this point, I think many, many people have decided which aisle to set their chair up in, and that's where they're, mm-hmm, going to camp out for the rest, mm-hmm, of this pandemic. But there's still some that are, they just want information. They're just, mm-hmm, not sure. And so I think it matters for leadership to take that step.
Oh, it definitely matters. Absolutely matters.
And some of them are high risk themselves. We know some of them are in an age population that's high risk. So
yes, yes.
You just
They
hope,
have gray hair, you know, just like I do.
Come well, I was going to say, I mean.
Yeah, but it's true.
It is true.
You know? I mean, you just can't. You can't just ignore it just because you'd rather ignore it, you know?
No, because if this was anything else, again, the word COVID has become polarizing.
Yes.
And if you could just get that part out of your head and think illness.
Yes.
Strong illness.
Right. Serious illness. Yes.
It seems like we don't feel this way about other illnesses, mm-mm, that we're trying to take care of as a community. I mean,
no.
Seriously, I know some folks, obviously, who are really against what I do, people very close to me. Mm-hmm. And I've never heard them, you know, when somebody has the flu, the first thing out of their mouths is like, I don't want to get sick. And so this should not be different just because the word is COVID. Regardless of the political issue going on in the nation that's been going on for the last 18 months, I ignore that. That is, mm-hmm, that has no relevance to us here in Curry County. This is an
right.
illness that is affecting our community, and mm-hmm, we're responsible for that.
Yep.
All of us.
Absolutely. So I guess we will see at the next council meeting, which I think is Monday.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Monday.
Whether they have put the plexiglass shields back up, mm-hmm, and whether our city council and staff decide that they should be masked to protect their citizens.
Yeah. Well, I guess, be. So.
No, so will I. Absolutely. So, and speaking of that workshop, so the workshop was specifically about two issues, the uptick in granting CUPs, conditional use permits,
mm-hmm,
right, to landlords who turn their single-family long-term rentals into short-term vacation rentals, and whether or not the council should take some action to, like, cap that number in the face of our affordable housing crisis, and the use of accessory dwelling units, ADUs, and what the city might be able to do to make that option more attractive and affordable to homeowners. To say that I am disappointed in the council's lack of concern about both of these issues is an understatement.
Mm.
I was shocked, actually. Just shocked. What did anything stand out for you, Diana, about that?
Well, I mean, I will say this. I really appreciate Councillor Alcorn continuously bringing it back around to specifically the words affordable housing. And just housing in general. I actually do appreciate him bringing it back around to that several times. And I appreciate Councilor Schreiber also trying to keep the conversation going around affordable housing, around mm-hmm. housing in general. But they both said those words, and they both kind of tried to get more conversation out of that. And so mm-hmm. I really appreciate that. And I talked to Councilor Schreiber afterward and told him that. So, you know, that aside, I do think that there needs to be a better understanding of some of the terminology and of our own demographics here as far as what our housing stock looks like and what our, you know, what our families look like, the area median income and whatnot. And so I think there needs to be a little bit more understanding with the council. And what I heard was that Mayor Hedenskog said that they were going to read the study that was put out in 2017,
right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So they were going to read through that, and I've read through that. I think some of the numbers that they were looking for, they were talking about how many units we needed here in Curry County, or here in Brookings, actually, just specifically Brookings. Mm-hmm. And the numbers for Brookings, I think it's somewhere around 552. Now, this is at the time of the study, 2017.
552 what?
So 552 regular, you know, at
market value?
Yes, at market value. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So 552 at market value units were needed, and 552 affordable housing units and subsidized housing units, and 113 at market value. So, you know,
wow. over, and that over was in 2017?
That was in 2017. So that's over 600, you know, that's what, 660, 670, whatever. Uh-huh. So 670 units that we needed, and the majority of them being affordable and subsidized housing. So,
right.
Yeah, I think that they're going to be looking at those numbers. We know that those are inflated, but they kept throwing the number 100 around, and that really was just the at-market rate housing. Mm. So
what is affordable? What's the definition of affordable housing?
Affordable housing is typically, I mean, it could be, so affordable housing is when what you're paying is no more than, or your income is no more than like 60% of the area median income. I think that there's some argument that it could be up to 80%, but typically, when you're low income, when you make about 60% or less of the area median income, and in Curry County, and in Brookings, I think Brookings might be higher. I'm almost positive it's higher, but you can mm-hmm. generalize that in Curry County, it's about 40,000, give or take. And so the average person makes 40,000, a year. Mm-hmm. And so if you were to take that and say, okay, what does low income look like? Well, at 80%, we're talking about 32,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is 2,700 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were going to calculate the rent, which can only be a third of your income, for most places, they want it to be a third of your income. That's $890, just under $900 a month. So you'd have to find something at under $900 a month to be able to afford it. And that's at making $32,000 a year. So I don't know about you, but I haven't seen many rentals for $900 a month.
No, the likelihood of finding something like that is just about nil. Yep.
Yeah. And that's about $15 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And so if people were making $15 an hour, they would be able to afford $900 a month. So we know people are not making $15 an hour. Some are starting to, but that's the wage we're fighting for, is 80% of the area median income. Wow. So we're not even talking about a large amount. I mean, we're talking about a small bump that still puts us at poverty level. Right. Now, really low income would be 60% or less for sure. So 60% or less is like $24,000 a year. So you're thinking maybe $2,000 a month. So, you know, under $700 a month for income or for rent is what you can afford.
There's nothing out there for that. That's crazy.
Yeah. So that's affordable housing. So most affordable housing units will calculate that out. So they'll say, okay, area median income is 40,000. So we're 60,000 or less. So our rent is going to be 670 a month. And that's, you know, at 60% of the area median income, 670 is the max rent. Mm-hmm. So like these low income apartments and things like that, that's what it looks like for them. So that's affordable housing. And then mm-hmm. you have subsidized housing, which is basically the same, but HUD comes in and pays the remaining balance. And so if your rent is 670 a month, because that's the max, mm-hmm. but you don't make very much money, you know, you make maybe 1500 a month or 1000 a month or whatever the case may be, HUD will come in and pay part of your rent depending on your income, mm-hmm. so that your rent is not more than a third of your income. So if you can only afford 200 a month, which, you know, some people are making under $1,000 a month, you know, mm-hmm. they're not getting enough hours or they get very low wages. So mm-hmm. if you could only afford 200 a month, HUD would come in and pay $470 a month. So that's subsidized housing. So you can have low income subsidized housing for sure.
Now, there's a waiting list for HUD though, right? I mean, it's not like
there is a waiting list. Yes.
You don't just like sign up and get into a unit, right?
Well, wouldn't that be nice? Then we would definitely have more people do it. The reason why most people do not sign up for HUD when they could definitely qualify is that they hear the waiting list time and they just decide, my situation will change by then, I'm sure. Well,
it
doesn't.
Like 2 years or something, isn't it? I mean, it's ridiculous.
It is. It can actually be longer for some folks. And if you get to the top of that list and you get a voucher and you don't find a place within, I think it's 4 months. I don't remember the exact amount. You lose your voucher and you have to go back to the back of the line.
Ooh.
So with our housing shortage, you know, I'm sure we've heard of people losing their vouchers. So mm-hmm. that's absolutely a possibility. There's a wait list. You know, there's a wait list for the low income housing in general as well. So we definitely, you know, that's actually why I never applied for HUD. The wait list was 3 to 4 years at that time.
Wow.
And I thought, well, my situation will change. Mm. Well, it did, but it changed for the worse.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, and it's hindsight. Everybody does it. Everybody, you know, we don't apply because what's the point? And then later on, we wish we had. So I try to encourage people, just now it's online. It's super easy. It takes 5 minutes. Let's just apply.
So how do all of those differ from workforce housing?
Well, workforce housing is a little bit more geared towards some of the middle income levels. So we're talking about the actual area median income or, you know, workforce housing could technically be classified as 60 to 120% of area median income. So people who build workforce housing, I mean, it's generally just at market rate housing. That's basically what it is. The term workforce housing sometimes invokes this vision of every unit we build is going to be used for people who are working and contributing to our economy. But that's not true. So we have, you know, there are people on fixed incomes that move into workforce housing as well, because workforce housing is essentially at market rate housing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You can have workforce housing built to be under median income rate. So you can have it certainly be lower than market rate. And it's not necessary, right?
That's not a necessary part of the definition.
No, and there are probably people that know, you know, Beth probably could find some nuances in what I'm saying, so there may be some corrections in this, but no, workforce housing is generally, people that come along and do building for workforce housing are usually doing it for a specific purpose, like the mill needs, workforce housing. Mm-hmm. Or mm-hmm. the hospital needs workforce housing. And so it's kind of geared towards that. It does mm-hmm. not mean that everybody in those units is working at the mill.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just sort of an old term that we, you know, it used to be kind of, they'd slap together these, you know, in the railroad districts and stuff, they would slap together these housing units that weren't really meant to last for a long, long time. They were just meant to get people housed to do their work. And obviously it looks different now, but you know, we have a lot of regulations on housing. But I mean, essentially, workforce housing is that. It's just that. It's at market rate. And
while we need workforce housing, I mean,
of
certainly
course, yes.
we need it. That's yes. not all we need. I mean, now, we've got so many people here whose incomes fall below the median income that
essentially
those people are being told that, you know, that they don't matter, right?
Yeah, it's really when we start talking about you know, funding for workforce housing and whatnot, and we're not looking at affordable housing as well. We're actually now I'm not saying, you know, if a private builder was coming in or an entity was coming in and wanted to do workforce housing, every unit we get is great because some people are in affordable housing and can afford to move up or will be able to afford to move up soon,
right,
to general workforce housing or at market rate housing. And that will free up lower income units for other families, other people. So,
but I don't think that's going to be a huge exodus, do you?
No, no, it's not.
Yeah.
Because most people can't afford at market rate. So not right. here, at least. So when we just sit there and focus on workforce housing, like let's say with the ARP money, the ARP money, you know, like American Rescue Plan. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about that funding, we've heard a lot of different ideas of housing. In Brookings, like I said, we've heard a lot about affordable housing, mm-hmm. which has been very nice.
Mm-hmm.
At the county level, I hear a lot more talk about workforce housing, though that doesn't mean that's all I hear, but I hear more about that. And when mm-hmm. when people are talking about, you know, just spending a large chunk or just, you know, using a great deal of resources for just workforce housing, it really leaves out our seniors, our people with disabilities, our people who are making much, much less than the area median income. I mean, truly, most people aren't making $15 an hour. And like I said, that's only 80% of the area median income. So I think that when we're talking about only workforce housing, we're really missing the biggest chunk of people. Like I said, 552 units needed 4 years ago for affordable housing. So if we're just looking at workforce, we're missing the biggest chunk of people. It's yeah. harder to build, but that's what yeah. we need.
Yeah. And one of the things that struck me was I think they calculated that they had added 22 short-term vacation rentals. They had
yes.
converted 22 long-term rentals into short-term rentals in the last 2 years, maybe? Something
yeah, since 2018, I think end of 2018. So yeah.
Okay. So and the feeling by the council was, that's nothing. You know, 22 units, that's nothing, right? I mean, in a town comprised of 6,000 people, 22 units is nothing. And I just right. want to ask, have they talked to any of the 22 families that got evicted from those homes and ask them how important that was?
Well, I mean, I don't know, but I can imagine. And I thought about that too. And the thing is, it's not like we're saying like this will fix everything if we do that. We're saying that, hey, this is a leak and we need to fix it for right now, because right now we can't really afford to lose any units. So
right.
Yeah, I think that the, you know, looking at the short-term rentals, 22 in a couple of years, it may not seem like a lot to some, but when we have, what, 42 overall? So that means more than half have been in just 2 years. And for us who are really looking at this housing crisis, it's just all we see. And I know mm-hmm. that the optics, they talked about it, the optics is what's drawing the attention to it. Well, for a good reason, though. Right
yeah.
now is not the time to lose units. And while I agree that is not the biggest leak, it seems like that could be an easy one if we just put some type of regulation in. Like people can own one,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
Because then we know it's not people from out of the area that are just trying to get rich off of us.
Right.
It's people who live here, want to contribute, and like to have extra income, like to be good hostesses, because right. there's nothing wrong with having a short-term rental and being a hostess, you know?
No.
It's great.
But the other thing would be, you know, the location of the short-term rental. I mean, you don't turn a long-term family home in a neighborhood with schools into a vacation rental. I mean,
that stuck with me. Yeah.
Wow, me too. I mean, there's no ocean view, people. I'm here to tell you.
Yeah, you're just going to be waiting behind all the school buses like the rest of us.
Seriously, it just makes no sense to me.
That's not an experience you want as a tourist.
No. And the other thing that stood out to me was I think that Councillor Alcorn mentioned at least twice that he wanted to revisit the Lone Ranch Rio Tinto thing. And I think even Tony Barron at one point said, but that's not going to address the affordable housing
issue. Yeah.
And it won't, right? I mean, building out at Long Ranch isn't going to, what is that going to do?
Well, if they build or dedicate some of those to affordable housing, sure, it would be great.
Then they have to have, you know, transit, right, to get people into town.
And truly, if some company or some whatever, you know, wants to come in and develop that, if the city puts the infrastructure in place to develop that into even at market rate housing, great, but we should not be spending all of our money on that. We should definitely, I liked the idea of spending the money on infrastructure so that we can be ready to build when developers want, but we definitely need to invest some of that actually into housing itself. Yeah. So however that has to happen.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with Band-Aids. You know, I mean, it was kind of the Band-Aid approach is poo-pooed, but quite frankly, you know, when somebody is hemorrhaging, sometimes Band-Aids help, right?
They do have value. They do. I mean, I don't personally use Band-Aids on me, but in fact, I don't actually carry any in my house. But yes, they do have some value.
I got to tell you, I use them on my husband all the time because when he falls, he cuts himself, and
so
that needs to
men
be.
Men need Band-Aids. I'm just
there
saying.
There we go.
mine does too, so I get it.
There we go. We love them. So, you know, it looks to me like we're out of time again.
Yeah.
I don't know how that happens. Every single week that happens, Diana.
Yeah. It's like there's a clock somewhere.
It right? I wonder who's keeping track of that clock.
Tom.
Well, all right, so we need to go. Diana, we'll talk more about this next week, of course. And thank you for tuning in. We have at least two distinctly serious crises in our small town, the rapidly spreading COVID virus and the dire lack of affordable housing for our population. City Council and city staff need to hear your concerns before both issues spiral out of control. The solutions are there. The right people are in place. What are we waiting for? This is Candace Michelle for our community.